Brode is going to pitch out of the bullpen today. Just what goes into that?
Yeah, I think it's just part of the development. We've done it with all of our starters pretty much. I think we did it with Tidwell before, obviously, he got traded. We did it with McLean. Today's his Sprott's turn, you know. Part of the plan, part of the development. And I feel like, you know, our AAA staff, they do a really good job preparing these guys in case there's a need here. And, you know, before you know it, we need him to pitch out of the bullpen here. You know, it's kind of like in preparation for anything that can happen here. So it's another step for them in their development, and that's what we're doing.
It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Sunday, August the 24th, 2025. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X at TalkingMetsNoG and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. NoG, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. You can get me on Instagram at Talking Mets No G, and I'd love for you to subscribe to the newsletter, substack.com/@TalkingMetsNoG. For less than a price of a cup of coffee a month, you can get great premium content. And as always here, the Talking Mets podcast is free for everybody, commercial-free going forward. Welcome to another edition of the Talking Mets podcast. Hope everybody's having a great weekend as we charge into the symbolic end of summer, Labor Day. Where has the baseball season gone? Where has the summer gone? It's like you had your first little feel of fall this week here in New York. Some of the leaves falling, a little bit of chill, you know, high 50s, low 60s. I guess the weather was almost teasing the specter of postseason. Of course, the Mets and Mets fans, a lot of frustration on this Mid-Atlantic South road trip, 3-3. Disappointing loss here on a Sunday, a couple of really bad losses in the nation's capital, and the Mets head home to face the first-place Phillies without Zach Wheeler, and then the plunky upstart Miami Marlins at Citi Field, a critical week. And as I come to you here late on a Sunday, you know, the Reds are still playing. Maybe we'll get an update at some point throughout the show, but it looks like they're going to, you know, pick up a game at least on the Mets. They're up 5-1 in the eighth inning over the Arizona Diamondbacks. So the Mets are probably going to be a couple of games up on the last wild card spot heading into a big homestand here, kicking it off with the Phillies. So I talked a lot about this last, right after the Washington series for those that were the premium subscriber members. And, you know, I think you all pretty much know, and I've said it a lot on this show, this is not really a surprise, and I flip-flopped a lot because this team this year has really had fits and starts, and they've looked like a 100-win team, they've looked like a 100-loss team, and they've looked like something somewhere in between throughout the year. It's been one of the odder seasons, I think, that we've seen in a long time, and I think the emotional roller coaster the team has taken on the fans has resulted in, I think, everybody looking at this group in a lot more negative fashion than maybe they should, because I think the vibes of last year, the fun, all the other extracurricular stuff with the you know, the grimace and the OMG and the wild wins in the postseason, the adrenaline that comes from that, you know, I've said this over and over and over again, you kind of, you know, you get addicted to that, and then it's almost like everything else is pale in comparison. And as much as we all got excited about year two with Stearns and the Soto signing, and how, you know, you just figured everything that happened last year, whether it be the development of these, you know, starters like they did with Severino and Manaea last year, that the lab would have the Midas touch, and, you know, an improved bullpen, and potentially the lengthening of the lineup, you know, maybe some of the kids, you know, having a year more of experience. You know, everything all year has been inconsistent. And I think that puts you in a spot where you look at this team as a disappointment. But waking up here you know, on a Sunday, and even with the loss here today, if you look at the Pythagorean breakdown of the Mets' one, you know, the runs scored, they're pretty much exactly who they should be, about a 69-61 team, and a team that, fortunately for them, the wild card has come back to them that last spot. Because as you look at the rest of their schedule, a lot of road games, tough road series. They got to go to Philly for a four-game set. September is going to have some tough series. And they have quite a hard schedule, you know, playing a lot of winning teams late in the year. It's going to be hard to see this team running off. And examples, again, how they had a brutal loss here today. I mean, how many times are they going to get beat by either walking or giving up big hits to guys with 550, 600 OPSs at the bottom of lineups? I mean, it seems like it happens every day almost, even in games that they win. But it's going to be hard to see this team winning as many games as last year. It's hard to see them winning 90 games. This is going to be a critical week. I mean, the Reds are going out to the to face the Dodgers. You know, maybe if the Mets could win a couple of games here at Citi Field against the Phillies. You know, I'm not even looking at division right now. I'm looking at the Mets just continuing to peck away. I think about 87 to 88 wins should do it, even with the Reds right behind them. But it's no shoo-in, and I think it's going to take winning in a big series in Cincinnati in September for the Mets to get this done. So there's going to be a lot of ebbs and flows to the season with about 5 weeks left or so. And, you know, I'm really not going to be in the business here of complaining about where I want the Mets to be. And we've talked a lot about what Stearns took over and why he had to do some of the things with the pitching. You know, I don't want to hear about the deadline now that Ryan Helsley's a mess. I know some people are complaining about Tyler Rogers. Honestly, he is who he is. He's a guy that throws ground balls, doesn't strike out a lot of guys and throws strikes. I mean, you need guys like that in the bullpen. You know, Soto, you know, you could question maybe the move with Mendoza, keeping him against a right-handed batter. I think part of what Mendoza does with this bullpen, a lot of what he has to look for is the fear in a lot of ways that if he overuses a bullpen too matchup-driven late in games, what happens the next day if his guys get knocked out in the fourth inning? You know, he's got to go to that bullpen early. So I think that that might be hanging over Mendoza's head a little bit. Soto's a guy that you don't want to have up against a big right-handed batter. He doesn't profile well at that. But, you know, at some point, if you mix and match too much, especially, and in this case, Peterson went into the sixth, he ran out of gas, some unfortunate loss of control there. So again, I'm not going to get too deep into that. I know that there's some people that are, you know, starting to focus on the in-game moves of Mendoza. The Mets are 69-61, not because Mendoza makes a bullpen move here or there. They're 69-61 because they're overall an inconsistent team in every facet. And they've got a lot of guys that have had, you know, Vientos is hitting now. He didn't hit for most of the year. Beatty is hitting now, hasn't hit most of the year. I mean, you could go to all the different aspects of the team and you can see that, you know, they basically you know, never have had everything on all cylinders. I mean, heck, Pete Alonso left seven guys on base today. I mean, there's your ball game. Let's face it. There's your ball game right there. Pete gets a couple of big hits. And I'll tell you, one of the things I did notice this weekend, if you watch closely, and you want to blame the hitting coach, I think it's nothing to do with the hitting coach. I think it has to do with, and maybe it's an organization philosophy, but I think it's just a modern game. You'll see, I think it was yesterday, there was before the McNeil three-run homer. This is a perfect example of how, you know, Alonso's up, a couple of runners on. This is why Alonso's never going to be vintage Paul Goldschmidt when Goldschmidt was hitting 300 and MVP candidate. Second and third, one out, and he hits a ball really hard, but right at the third baseman, pins the runner at third. Fortunate for the Mets, McNeil came up and hit a three-run dinger because Vientos then, I think, struck out right after that. And that's kind of like the lack of situational hitting. Maybe that's part of what ails them when runners are scoring position. Now, no, Soto, to his credit, and in the ninth inning, you saw he went the other way. You know, he's starting to come around in that facet. I think that that's another big thing that has led to some of the inconsistencies throughout the year. Yeah, this big transition contract situation with Soto that maybe we thought would last a short period of time lasted a lot longer. So, you know, we all have talked about on and on and on all year on this show the various points that I've made up here in the open. So we all know about it. What it is now, it's going to get it done. And if you're going to get things done, doesn't matter what happened before. And part of what this team you know, focusing on the deadline, focusing on what happened in the offseason, focusing on, oh, well, Montas has got a torn UCL and they shouldn't have signed him. That's not the conversation now. It's about execution. And if you're going to leave seven guys on base like Alonso did, you're going to lose ball games. If you're going to walk the seventh and eighth hitters in on second division clubs, you're going to lose ball games. If you're going to hit players with 0-2 counts, you're going to lose ball games. It's as simple as that. You're going to lose ball games. This is an example of a ball game that had nothing to do with the trade deadline and nothing to do with the offseason and nothing to do with any of it. It doesn't have to do with anything to do with Soto's mom's clothing allowance. It had to do with the fact that your big hitter in the middle of the lineup couldn't execute a couple of more than one situation. I think three situations he couldn't execute with the big hit. And your bullpen and your starter lost guess walked mediocre hitters instead of going after them. He danced around them. And that, to me, is the ball game right there. Now, if that's a pitching philosophy, which, you know, they were talking about it on the broadcast today, Darling saying, you know, maybe Hefner went out there and told Peterson your fastball's starting to elude you, you know, go breaking. We don't know. You know, there really wasn't anything I saw in the post game that talked about it. But anyway, you know, it's about execution. The Mets didn't execute, and unfortunately, it's a 50-50 shot because they pretty much have been a 500 team now for a few weeks. Whether they get the job done night in or night out. And I think that's where the emotions go high and the emotions go low. But there is an opportunity, I think, for the Mets to do something bold. And this is a total 180 from my conversation about the starting rotation not even a month ago. If you remember when the talk about the kids came up, McLain and Tong and Sproat, I was like, hold on, timeout. There is no way Stearns, who is conservative by nature, is going to take a page out of the 2015 Sandy Alderson book when he went to Steven Matz, when he went to Noah Syndergaard, and plug those two guys in the rotation. And let's face it, if the Mets relied on a Dylan G, if the Mets relied on a Jonathan Nease, if the Mets had to go out and get a veteran back in the rotation arm, I don't know if you were able to. They certainly wouldn't have went to the World Series, but I don't even know if they would have made the postseason. Those were bold moves. Now, whether you want to argue Syndergaard and Matz were further along, I mean, that's, you know, a conversation for another day. The blueprint at the early in the year was, you know, to go with veterans like Dylan G and John Nease. And this year, the plan was to go with Frankie Montas and Griffin Canning and, you know, Tyler McGill and so on and so forth. And I didn't think there'd be any chance, especially with Paul Blackburn on the squad, maybe the specter of McGill coming back. At that point, we didn't know that Montas was pitching with the UCL that was about to break. So I was like, hey, you know, the Mets are not paying $17 million a year to release Frankie Montas to throw a kid who's pitching well at AAA, but just starting to pitch well, into the heat of the pennant race. But, you know, and maybe Nolan McLain changed all this with the way that he went out and shut down a very hot Seattle team and the way that he went into Atlanta. And albeit, I understand it's a second division club, but a club that could put up some points on the board, especially in that ballpark, especially on a humid night. You know, give him credit. He's probably a little bit nervous. He grew up a Braves fan. And again, he showed, I mean, and the off the charts, you know, spin on this guy's stuff. I mean, we're talking like maybe 30% higher than average on some of these things. It makes you excited. And then you look and you see how he goes out and he gets some ground balls in the middle innings to make himself be even put into a position to go seven. Never mind the fact that how effective he was. I mean, part of what's lost in pitching is that, hey, you know, what is better? Go five innings and strike out 13 or go seven innings, strike out seven and maybe pitch a little deeper into the ball game and get yourself a win. So you start to see that. Stearns now is looking at that. Now the news comes out. Second great start by Jonah Tong down in AAA, a guy that we didn't think we'd see. I would say I thought midseason next year, you know, maybe start to get some play. And, you know, same thing with McLain. I thought McLain for sure. All right, you know, he'll come into spring training. He'll start to be in the conversation. You know, he'll come up, you know, maybe a month after the season starts. You figure you want them to get more time at AAA. But they are showing such maturity and such development. And I'm sure part of that has to do with the feedback they're getting from the coaches down in the minors, that now Jonah Tong has put himself on the radar for this season. And then Brandon Sproat, the news comes out today, Brandon Sproat, who, you know, originally everyone thought would be the first one to get the call. Now he's going to the bullpen. And I'm trying to gather some information and some of the things that are making the rounds on, you know, X and everything, well, maybe they're just going to work on some of his, shaping of pitches, and, you know, maybe having him, you know, with his innings limit, be a viable option to either piggyback or be a true bullpen option come the postseason. And let's also remember, I mean, this is something Corbin Burnes, Freddie Peralta, you know, there's a history of Stearns doing this. And shoot, even the Dodgers, to a certain degree, have brought guys out of the bullpen over the years, big pitching prospects. I mean, you look, Ben Kasparis. There's a guy, and I'm actually going to bring up his numbers while we're here. You know, there's a guy that got some starts in the minors, and, you know, he's come up and he's been working out of the bullpen as a member of the Dodgers at this point. So, you know, maybe the Mets are pulling a page out of that book. Now, there's going to have to be some machinations of the 40-man roster here, and I would assume that Frankie Montas soon will go on the 60-day IL, so that'll open up a spot. And they're going to have to potentially designate somebody else for assignment. I'm wondering if, and at this point with the way Ryan Stanek has been pitching and how he's fallen off the cliff, you have to think that, you know, he's a big prime candidate designated for assignment. They want to hold on to a veteran. You know, maybe it's a Davinsky or somebody like that that gets thrown off, you know, Hergert, you know, Kevin Hergert, you know, guys like that get thrown off the roster. But I think Stearns, for the first time in his tenure, and it's a very short tenure, again, we're not even 2 years in here, he's, for the first time in a, you know, acting bold. And that's not something we saw. I mean, even last year, with the way he approached the deadline, with the way he went about bringing in Maton, when he brought in Stanek, you know, pseudo scrap heap, Jesse Winker, guys like that, Brazenbaum from Miami, you know, these were conservative moves. Tyler Zubar, who has been was a disaster. I mean, they basically gave away Eric Orsi, and they could use him now. You know, these were very conservative moves. These were moves to just, you know, not go too far out of the box. Now, he was a little bit more bold at the trade deadline with his prospect capital. And right now, it's not looking great. I mean, the Cedric Mullins was something where he just could not live with Taylor's bat. I mean, if Tyrone Taylor hit the way you thought he would, about league average, they probably never make the Mullins deal, I don't think. Helsley's been a disaster. I mean, actually, out of all the reasons to be pessimistic and maybe to push potentially putting another arm in the rotation, not just to get to the six-man rotation, and we'll see how Senga pitches tomorrow on short rest, but also potentially bringing Sproat out of the bullpen, is that right now, between Reed Garrett still being very inconsistent, you don't know what you're going to get out of Brazenbaum. He's back up in the big leagues. And Helsley being a mess, I mean, your A bullpen squad now is Soto, Raleigh, Diaz, and Tyler Rogers. And that's not bad. That's better than what the Mets had earlier in the year. But let's face it, you brought Helsley in to make this, basically a shutdown situation. And I wouldn't be surprised if the reason that Soto pitched to a righty is that they can't trust Helsley right now. He's a mess. I mean, he came into an 8-run lead, and he didn't make it tight. But a couple more batters get on. Diaz was warming up. I mean, that's crazy. So, you know, you're seeing this, you're watching this on Friday. I'm fuming. I'm sure you're fuming. I guarantee you the front office is fuming. And, you know, I understand what Mendoza's saying. They're working on it. They got all this. I mean, what is he going to say? I mean, you guys want him to go out there and rip these players to the media. It's never going to happen. And, you know, now is time. And Stearns is looking down at AAA. He's looking at these release points by Tong, a kid that's showing a ton of confidence. And you got history here where just 10 years to the date, you know, at this time 10 years ago, we were watching Mats and Syndergaard. I know Harvey and DeGrom were up a little bit more, but you were watching basically inexperienced pitchers carry this club to a World Series. And let's not forget Michael Conforto, who a year before that, was playing in Brooklyn. So this has happened before. This has happened in Mets history. Other teams do that. I mean, shoot, the Anaheim Angels back in 2002 brought up K-Rod in September, and he became a big piece of their championship run. So it does happen. It's out of character for Stearns. And it's something that I'm not always comfortable with, But at this point, you're an in-the-muck team. What's the worst that's going to happen? If you go down and don't make the postseason, and the reason is you get bad performances out of a Tyler McGill, out of a Helsley, out of all these, you know, established veterans, what's the harm in putting in a kid with upside? And I'm now sounding like the people that have been criticizing me, like a Spro, like a Tong. You know, obviously McLean in two starts has shown a lot of moxie. I mean, you're putting a lot of pressure on these guys. And look, part of it is almost patently unfair. You're throwing these kids. It's literally like they just learned how to swim. They're training to be Olympic athletes. You just learned how to swim. And by the way, before you even really get to do some like significant exhibition work, you're thrown into the deep end of the pool. You're thrown into competition at a high level. And look, take it from a guy that believes in pushing people in competitive situations. That's a big part of my DNA. But you know, relying on rookies is not usually, you know, something you want to do at this time of the year. I mean, historically, you know, especially as I watched sports growing up, rookies, especially their first couple of years, they kind of, you know, sat on the bench. They learned their trade. They got eased into situations. But you know what? There were exceptions. I've brought up Greg Jeffries and how he came up in 1988 and helped the Mets make the postseason. We just talked about the 2015 Mets. You know, we've brought these kind of, you know, Melvin Mora in 1999. So it has happened. And I think, you know, maybe because we get so caught up in development, so caught up in the process, so caught up in, you know, innings limits and all this other stuff, that quite honestly, you know, we've forgotten that maybe you bring these kids up. I mean, look, the Mets even did a 99 with Dotel when he come up as a starter. You know, throw them into the deep end of the pool. Give them a chance to prove themselves. At this point, I think the Mets need to do something bold. Not only from a standpoint of navigating what's going to be a tough schedule, but I think what we've seen with McLean is that has injected some energy into a team that maybe, and you want to blame Mendoza for this, you want to blame last year's success for this, I think has maybe been looking towards the postseason again. Is that fair to say? I'm not saying they're not trying, and I'm not saying this is the scattery and bored Mets team of 2007. I'm not comparing those two. And there are certainly deficits on this team, without a doubt. There are deficits on this team in consistency, whether it be the way the bullpen started the season, how they rolled the dice with the rotation. That was probably something they had to do unless they wanted to take on risky contracts or make maybe risky trades. The transition for Soto, the inconsistencies of the kids. You know, I think that, you know, this kind of injection of energy and moxie, kids that really are going to come up here and maybe they've personality profiled them. If they're anything like McLean, who's been as cool as the, you know, to quote the old, you know, ESPN quote, what was it, Stuart Scott, cool as the other side of the pillow. I mean, why not? Why not? It just makes a ton of sense. So I think from the fan standpoint, it'll inject some energy into the fan base that I think has gotten frustrated and angry. And we haven't even gotten, and we won't get to that this year, to some of the exciting positional players. And by the way, if you start following reports, whether it's our friend Ernie Dove or just go into the Mets top 30 prospects at Pipeline or MLB.com and start looking at some of the talent that's at AA and maybe even Brooklyn, I mean, in another year or so, there might be more. So what I'm saying is this: sit back, enjoy this pennant race, enjoy, you know, baseball. As frustrating as today is, you know, this is a good spot. The Mets are in a much better spot than they were 5 years ago. And this is probably one of the best spots this franchise has been in a long time, with the combination of major league resources and potential minor league resources. And I know the scary part, which we talked about a week ago, is that if these kids bust, get hurt, or not anywhere near who we think they are, even after two, I mean, I got people like out on X saying they should extend Nolan McLean after two starts. Slow down. Like, stop spending Cohen's money. Let the kid get through, oh, I don't know, a couple of months or a couple of times around the league before we start anointing him the next Doc Gooden. But, you know, I think that this is going to be a really interesting and fun end of the season. And the kids and this bold, potential bold move which will require 40-man machinations, which as long as these guys are on the 40-man roster, even if they're not called up, as long as they're on the 40-man roster by August 31st, 11:59 p.m., that is that by this time next Sunday, well, then they're going to be postseason eligible, and then we could have something very interesting. And how much fun would it be watching the existing guard and the new injection of youth merge itself together? And maybe, maybe not this year, maybe it'll happen next year, but the Mets finally have the breakthrough that we've been waiting for after the innocent climb of OMG Grimace of 2024. All right, we're going to take a quick break because I need a break. And when we come back, second half of the show, last week during the Little League Classic, Rob Manfred mentioned expansion. He mentioned realignment. It brought a lot of conversation on the day off. I wrote about it. I gave my proposal, so to speak, over at Beyond the Mic for those that are subscribers to the premium content. I'm going to expand on that. People asked me to expand on that. And actually, John Smoltz weighed in on what he thinks could happen. And even Bob Nightingale, and sometimes with Bob Nightingale, you got to be careful when he puts stuff up there, throughout what potentially MLB's been thinking about for the last, you know, 10 years of what an expanded scenario was. Jason Stark talked about the amount of scheduling and changes to the schedule and the death of the 162-game season. So I'm going to talk about that. I'll talk about, you know, why expansion is going to be and how it's really necessary to realign, I think, for the future of the sport on many different levels. You're listening to the Talking Mets podcast. We'll be back with more right after this.
In my mind, I think if we provides us with an opportunity to geographically realign, I think we could save a lot of wear and tear on our players in terms of travel. And I think our postseason format would be even more appealing for, you know, entities like ESPN, because you'd be playing up out of the East, out of the West, and that 10 o'clock time slot where we, you know, sometimes get Boston, Anaheim,
yes,
would be two West Coast teams, and that 10 o'clock slot that's a problem for us sometimes becomes a real opportunity for our West Coast audience. So I think, you know, I think the owners realize that there's demand for Major League Baseball in a lot of great cities, and that we have an opportunity to do something good around that expansion process.
When you hear expansion's coming to Major League Baseball, what do you think?
If you're going to add two teams, go full bore, go all in, make all the changes you want, realign and get the playoff structure different. To me, the perfect scenario of 32 teams is you get 4 8-team divisions. If you have a first half, second half schedule, and you have a first half winner and a second half winner, and then a wild card that combines that didn't win either half, you have two playoff races. You have July, which is not boring now. You have a race to the playoffs in the first half. If you secure that spot, you're in the playoffs at the end of the year. And then people go, well, what's the incentive of winning the second half? And then you get a bye. Because if you don't win the second half winner plays the first half winner to right to go on. Well, what happens if you have the overall best record and didn't win first half or second half, which happened to the Cincinnati Reds during the 84 season? That's where the wild card team comes in. To me, this gives a franchise no more of an excuse to quit on the year or to try to lose to build up their farms. This gives a fan base an accountability to say, hey, I know, perfect example, Atlanta Braves got everybody hurt in the first half. Well, in the second half, if they started from scratch, don't you think they would approach it a little bit differently? And then your juggernauts, your teams that have to go out and are expected to win, well, go all in. So, yes, that's a long-winded answer to tell you I am all for two more teams.
If and when the league decides to expand, what two cities come to mind for you?
I mean, I'm in Charlotte right now, so Charlotte's a great city. Obviously, Nashville has been talked about. You got the return maybe to Montreal. You go out west, I've heard Portland. I've heard all kinds of different scenarios that could make sense.
All right, we're back. So let's take a break from the pennant race for, about 15, 20 minutes and address something that we talked about over at Beyond the Mic. And it's a week old, but it's been talked about throughout the week, and it came up again with a couple of pieces this week. And Jason Stark over at The Athletic, Bob Nightingale of USA Today brought it up. And I think that the first things first when it comes to radical realignment and expansion, we are five years away from this. And when I say 5 years away, maybe 5 years away from next year. And I think the real conversation of whether expansion will happen and what that looks like probably is going to be part of a collective bargaining situation next year. So next year we have a season. We don't know what's going to happen after the season. So you go 26 into 27, and then you have this 5-year runway that gives, you know, basically 7 years for everybody to figure out what's going on in with the A's in Vegas. I was just out in Vegas a couple of weeks ago. It looks like they're breaking ground out there for something. I'm assuming that's the ballpark. They already have the Raiders out there. And, you know, eventually I know that there's the sale of the Rays. You know, what's going to happen with Tampa? I mean, honestly, Orlando's one of the fastest growing cities, you know, in Florida, and the Magic have been wildly successful down there. I personally don't think Florida, because of the Northeast transient New Yorker component of that area, and we've talked about this for years, for decades about it, they're really not good sports towns. At least for baseball, from a baseball perspective, but maybe they look into something that maybe Tampa, you know, somehow gets into the mix for one of these cities that are out there. So just keep in mind, when we talk about this here in August of 2025, we're going to be talking about this a lot more. And the earliest we see anything happen, I think, is 5 to 7 years away. And if we're doing Talking Mets in 5 to 7 years, which I plan on if you guys still want to listen to me, and God willingly, I'm still here, we'll talk about it a lot then, but it is fun. It is something that I think I got some emails from people saying, hey, let's expand on this. And I know, and let me just say something here. And I think I got some really good feedback, and I appreciate feedback on email. When I tell you to contact me at MikeSilvat@talkingmetspodcast.com, I don't always respond right away. I read everything. I hear everything. And sometimes I'll address it. I don't like to give people's names out on the air, because I don't know if they want their names out there, but I address it, and I get some consistent people that contact me, sometimes even during the game. I get people that contact me here and there, you know, a lot of activity on X, and I'm on X a lot because I'm trying to look at the news feed in real-time situations. But, you know, one of the pieces of feedback I got is, hey, you know, you're on X interacting with people, you don't respond as much on email. You know, that's fair, and I should do a better job of that, so shame on me. So if I haven't done a good job in that and you're upset with me, you're right. I will do a better job at that. And I encourage. And it's all sorts of feedback. MikeSilva@talkingmetspodcast.com. No G. You could, you know, yell at me, you know, whatever. You know, you could do. Don't threaten my life. That would be nice. I don't want to feel, you know, threatened, but you could say whatever you want. I don't take offense. I don't personalize it. I think it's important for me to be some kind of sounding board for this fan base, because I always, like I said, whether you like it or agree with it, or feel I've done a good job with it, I've kind of tried to be this bridge between the mainstream and the fanaticism of fan conversation and whatnot. But back to the point here. So, radical realignment and a change in the way baseball is structured has to happen. Period, end of story. I don't know if expansion will happen. All I do know is that, and I don't know what's the future holds, you're seeing a radical shift in population to places like Nashville, places in Florida. You know, Texas is exploding. You know, Charlotte is a growing and burgeoning area. North Carolina, South Carolina, I have family members that have gone down there. And I currently live on Long Island. I grew up in New York City and Brooklyn. I'm a lifelong New Yorker. To say that I could see myself anywhere else, it'd be really, really hard. Once you establish a routine and know things and have the conveniences of this city that's not too far away where I am on Long Island, but that you just kind of know your way around, it's really hard to leave. Obviously, people leave for a variety of reasons: opportunity, family, cost of living, quality of life. There are a lot of things, even if you're in a very nice part of New York, that you know, the cost of it and the rat race to keep it up, these are things that are shifting the population. And the point of this is that with that shift to population, cities now that were not viable in 1998 or 1961 or 62 when the league was expanding, or in the 70s, are now viable and potentially can be revenue-generating areas. I mean, Vegas to me, you know, I've gone to Vegas a lot over the last 20 years. I never thought of it as anything more than a pit stop to hang out for a wild weekend, but it's, you know, burgeoning. I see it every time I go there. I see how the crowds are for the WNBA when I'm there. There's always a WNBA game going on. So, you know, I don't think those are just people going there on vacation. I think that there is a burgeoning population there. And as people try to maybe get out of California or move out of Colorado or for whatever reason where they're moving to the outskirts to try something different, you know, these become more viable. I was surprised to see Salt Lake City on there, but they've had a very successful NBA franchise for a long time. So, you know, you hear about Portland, you hear about Charlotte, you hear about, you know, Orlando maybe, Montreal. I don't think the Canadian economy and the relations between the United States and Canada, which could be vastly different in, you know, 2 or 3 years or even now. I mean, things are very fluid, but I think one of the reasons why Montreal wasn't a success was the geopolitical makeup of Montreal. I think the nostalgia of what the Expos were and what they actually were in real time are two different things. You know, I hear San Jose, you know, you already have the Giants. Do you want to go back to that? You know, the A's could have made that move. They decided not to. You know, Nashville, a very burgeoning, you know, especially the surrounding areas. So, you know, personally, the word on the street that you hear is that Nashville and Salt Lake City are the early front runners. But don't discount Charlotte, which currently has a minor league ballpark down there. You know, don't discount some of the others. I think if the only one that may be somewhat problematic, and again, from a geopolitical standpoint, is maybe Portland has, you know, lost a little luster for some of the things that have gone on there over the last 5 years. But for years, that was a beautiful city that wanted a team for years and have the Trailblazers that have been very successful there. So, you know, let's not count them out either. You know, a lot can change in a short span of time with the way that the world is right now. And money talks. So whoever has the investment group and the money and the plan, you know, sometimes the geopolitical situation can get thrown out the window. But more importantly, why this has to happen, and it's quite simple. It has to happen for competitive balance. You are in a situation where heading into, and this again is my opinion, and I am by no means somebody that's plugged in with the union, that's plugged in with the owners, that, you know, dives in every day and lives and breathes the business of baseball. I just, you know, a guy that connects the dots as an educated consumer and as someone who has a little bit of business acumen. But we all know that the players' union and the owners, outside of the kumbaya they had, you know, with Michael Wiener and the end of the Selig era, you know, post 9/11, you know, the success of the 90s, that has come to an end over the last, you know, 4 or 5 years with Tony Clark and some of the things that have gone on with Rob Manfred post Selig. I think the players have looked back and felt they were taken advantage of, you know, maybe a decade or so ago. And I think the owners are in a position where they are not going to be symbiotic, you know, like some of the other sports where they're all going to work together, share revenues, and have a situation that, you know, looks a lot like, you know, the NFL. They're not going to do it. You know, it's just not something that I think will happen. And the players are never going to agree to a salary cap. And I don't know how the owners are going to feel about, you know, especially the rich teams, you know, handicapping themselves as well. As a fan of a wealthy team, the last thing you want to do is see what's going on in the NBA where the Knicks could go out and probably take an opportunity to win a championship and bring in some very good veteran pieces to round out their roster, and they can't because they can't fit them under the salary cap because they're at a threshold which would reduce their ability to make trades and to perform transactions. And I think it's an easy thing for fans to say, well, these are our wealthy owners. It's an $11 billion business model. And, I mean, let's face it, you know, it's a high overhead business model. Only a third of the business comes from ticket sales. You know, only 10% additional comes from concessions. So less than half, significantly less than half, comes from the in-game experience. It's about the national TV. It's about the local TV. It's about sponsorships. These are all things that, as you see them talk about, selling MLB.TV to ESPN, maybe any deal at Amazon, all these things that will come down the pike, that will bring in shared revenue for the league. And I think regardless of that shared revenue, because you have 40%-ish that is tied into ticket sales and concession parking, and then you have your local media, which is the big difference. The Mets' local media versus the Pirates' local media is a big difference. You're never going to have equities of scale here. Unless equity groups like the Mets were bought by the Dodgers, being Cohen's an individual, but he's pretty much with this kind of wealth and equity group, And even when you saw when the Mavericks were sold, they were sold to big money. You have to have equity. You know, I'm not saying they're not an individual that's wealthy, but you're talking about next level wealthy. The days of a used car salesman like Bud Selig buying a team, or Fred Wilpon as a real estate mogul, a rich real estate mogul, not filthy rich, mega rich, next generation, Jeff Bezos rich, regular rich people cannot buy a professional sports team. They can't afford it. They can't. The cash you need to get up, the cash flow you need to manage it and consistently manage it, you can't do it. And for people to say, well, they don't lose money, well, guess what? There's a lot of overhead in there. Is there an accounting game? Sure. But remember something. If I owned a team and I had generational wealth and I had to keep going into the kitty and I was a family member where my parents or my significant other was going into the kitty and taking away my generational wealth to buy a bullpen, I'd probably have a problem too and say, well, if you can't fund it from the business, why am I funding it? Right? So I know it's hard as fans to understand that. So the point here is I think you have to have competitive balance by, you know, a combination of adding playoff teams and a combination of regionalizing divisions. Now, the plan that you see put out there by Nightingale and what Smoltz talked about in the clip that is currently playing is about basically four 18 divisions. Much larger divisions, North, South, Midwest, East, things like that, West, Pacific, whatever you want to call it. And Smoltz is talking about a first half, second half winner. You know, there's talk on Jerry Krasnick of going back to the 154-game season. You play in your division 12 times. You play everybody else potentially six times. You reduce the season by a week. Maybe you have some kind of wild card situation. And away you go. I actually think 18 divisions still are too big. And I think the best way to do this is to chop them up into smaller divisions. Now, I'll share with you, and, you know, again, this was for paid subscribers, but, you know, I think we want to share this conversation. For me, what you have to do first is to put the big money teams in some way, shape, or form together. So the Mets, the Yankees, the Red Sox, those are the three big money teams have to be in the same division. And Rogers does own Toronto, but from a standpoint of travel, you put them in that division. Now, you could argue maybe they could be in a division with Detroit, you know, north over there, but Toronto to New York, it just seems clean. And then you put your next tier, you put your Nats, your Orioles, similar markets, the Phillies, you know, maybe by the time the Pirates get a new owner, you know, maybe they could figure that out. I know the Phillies are a big market team, and ideally you'd have them with the Mets, but you also have to make the divisions make sense. You have to, you know, balance them out. And then you have yourself a Southeast division that has your expansion Nashville, it has your Miami, it has your Tampa, or assuming they stay in the Southeast after they're sold, and it has your Atlanta Braves. Again, small market teams in there in Tampa and Miami. We don't know what the Nashville situation would be, and I'm just picking Nashville because that's what I originally thought that's what makes sense, but that's also what people are saying is on the table. So I'm just taking the information that's out there. And Atlanta has some corporate money, but I don't think those checkbooks are going to be limitless. I think that division is pretty good. And then you go to the Midwest division. Well, you got the Cubs in there, but even the Rickett family has shown they'll spend, but they're not Cohen level, not Red Sox level, not Yankees level. You have the Reds, you have the Indians, very similar type of spending. The White Sox, very similar type of spending, at least now under Reinsdorf. And then you have your Western teams. You have your Seattle's, your San Francisco's. That's a big spending team. Minnesota and potentially, let's say, Portland's your expansion. I put Portland in there. But, you know, maybe that changes. Maybe, you know, you have to figure that out. And then you have, you know, the Dodgers, the Angels, the Padres. And eventually you would think the A's going to Vegas changes their financial situation. You put your D-backs, your Astros, your Rangers, and your Colorado Rockies in the Southwest. You put your Central, which is St. Louis, Kansas City, Milwaukee, Detroit. And now you align your playoffs. You have four division winners, you know, in each Eastern and Western conference. I did it by conferences. And then you have, you know, the wild card could be the top non-divisional winners from each league. The team with the best division record gets a bye. The two top wild card teams play in a best of three to determine who advance. After that, the playoffs go division winner two plays the wild card. Division winner three plays division winner four. And basically the division winner with the best record, you know, gets some time off and then they play, you know, essentially they're getting a bye all the way to, you know, playing less. Now, you know, there could be debate if that's a good thing and whatnot. But to me, in a scenario like that, where you have an Eastern and a Western Conference, you regionalize the teams based on their market so that you're putting people together, you're putting teams together that have similar local media opportunities. Because remember, if you go by the information that's out there, 23% of revenue for a team is local and TV media. The other, you know, 30 to 40% is the team itself in the terms of the ballpark and the sponsorship. And then there's this quarter of it, which is the national TV, which everybody shares in. So if the pie gets big, you'll get some of that money too. You know, again, if you're putting people together that have similar local revenues, and I know that there'll potentially be maybe some penalties for not spending, or maybe there'll be a cap on the big market teams. But if you're throwing, rather than capping salary, which is the players are never going to agree to that. If you put competitive teams of similar financial means together, they're all not going to make the playoffs. Maybe a couple of them will. Somebody's going to have a good record, or maybe they're going to beat everybody up. Somebody's not going to make the playoffs. You are, in fact, and maybe, and I'm not a big expert on this, and you guys in the audience could provide feedback. It's almost like European soccer with the series, you know, the top division, was it Series A, and then Series B, Series C. I don't know. I've known this. I've talked about this. I don't know it off the top of my head. But I'm essentially doing a version of that. Now, it's not perfect, because you're always going to have an owner that's in this group that's going to potentially spoil the broth. But if you're an owner and you're hiring a smart front office and you're in a division that's eminently winnable with similar type of markets like yours, then aren't able to go out and sign Juan Soto on a whim and aren't able to go out and absorb bad contracts, you might be more inclined to invest more, even if it's on a different level than what the Mets, the Yankees, the Red Sox do. And, you know, I think that that would work. And I think it would potentially make the sport more competitive. It would keep more cities involved. It would reduce the unnecessary travel. You'd be traveling more in your time zone. I know one of the things that Manfred brought up, you guys heard it on the clip coming in, is that, you know, you want to have fans be able to watch games that are in their time zone. Let's face it, we're all fanatics that listen to this broadcast. But there are a good chunk, if not more, Mets fans that are not going to stay up at 10:30 to 1:30 in the morning watching them play in San Francisco. They're not going to live and die with every pitch on a West Coast trip. You know, they're going to want the game to be within their life. And I think the other thing, that because there's so many more options and things for people to do, and we've talked about this time and time and time again, you have to keep fans engaged with them, believing they can win and have a chance at something. And that's where expanded playoffs, without watering them down, because here you're kind of breaking things up in, you know, even though you're maybe be a 500 team or maybe in low 80s team, if you're in the right division with the right kind of teams that are in the same financial stratosphere, maybe you're all kind of winning 82, 83 games. Now, I know what you're going to say. Why are they going to let mediocrity enter the postseason? You're already in a tournament situation. If the Mets win 85 games this year, they get into the postseason, they have as good a chance of going to the World Series, in theory, as the Los Angeles Dodgers or anybody else that's had a great season. And I understand about the integrity of the sport, the American League and the National League, and the history, and, you know, not wanting to make this where it's now the NBA and, you know, a 41-win team like the Houston Rockets did a few years ago back in the 80s makes it to the championship. Here's the problem, guys. You need to have a business, and you have to adapt to a changing world. We can't watch and perform and treat baseball like it's 1961 anymore. We can't. As much as we'd love to, as much as we'd like to look for the good old days, as much as, you know, and look, give baseball credit. These are radical ideas for a sport that it took them until the mid-90s to get a wild card. If the sport is going to survive and have a new audience, and I don't want it to turn into the Savannah Bananas, let's put it that way, it's going to have to engage people in something meaningful. You can't wake up on May 31st if you're a fan in Pittsburgh or Minnesota, Kansas City, Colorado, and you can't spend your summer just to go to the ballpark to have a good time for a team that is not going anywhere. You can't be a fan of a team like the Pirates that hasn't been able to compete in over 10 years. You can't do it. You're going to lose a generation of fans. They are going to tune out. Going to the ballpark, and you could have all the entertainment there, all the pitching machines, all the food, all the restaurants, all the non-baseball related things that gather people there. That's still an important part of the experience. But that is not enough to have a business, because I could go and do that at Six Flags Great Adventure. Shoot, how many people have these virtual reality experiences? They could do stuff online. There's, you know, so many experiences you could do in so many different venues. I mean, what really bothered me the most, and it should bother Rob Manfred, is that if you looked at the Little League Classic and some of the favorite players or athletes, I should say, that were listed by the poll of these, you know, kids, and I understand there was an international component to the group, there was a couple of football players, soccer players up there. You know, there was a baseball player, Lindor, I think, was up there. But, I mean, come on. You know? The days of it being about Mickey Mantle and the Yankees and Babe Ruth are long gone. So basically, to expand on this, what I really said in my piece and what I really think you have to look at any change is you have to look at travel and viewability of the game. You have to look at finances and competitive balance. And you have to look at it through the lens where basically the Players Association, the owners, are polar opposites on a lot of issues. And I think the bridge is very... it's a very wide gap to bridge. And I think the way you do it without compromising player salary or making the players feel like they're having their future earnings cut off unfairly based on the fact that you only have 800 of these guys in the world to do what they do. And if the market bears X, they should be able to get X and not say you could only get Y because that's the most you're allowed to make under these rules. If you regionalize the powerhouses of spend, which is easy to see because it all comes from certain regions because that's where the money, that's where the population is. And that could change, guys. By the way, that could change in 10 years. I don't think New York will ever not be where the money is, but let's face it, you know, the Philadelphia Phillies weren't always a big spending ball club. As a matter of fact, at one point, just about 20 years ago, they were a revenue sharing club before they went on that run in the mid-2000s. That's true. Look it up. Look at revenue sharing teams. So I think that's the lens you have to look through it. I think this is a fun exercise to gossip about and to talk about and to debate. And the fact that it got so much attention tells me there's still a lot of passion for the sport of baseball. And look, you could have fun with it in your fantasy leagues, or if you play Strat-O-Matic and you want to do it now and see how it plays out, you could do that. That's cool. You know, look, there's all sorts of things. But the reality is that the first step, or the next step really, which is the first step, is collective bargaining. And between now and collective bargaining at the end of next year, the only thing that we should be worried about here as Mets fans, as baseball fans, is potentially you know, how this team can get in the playoffs and maybe win a championship. Because you don't know what the rules are going to be 2027 and above. And if the divisions change, it could get a lot harder for the Mets to achieve that goal. So we'll see that. So that's really what I have. You know, I think that, like I said in the opening, it will be a very interesting to see how the Mets approach and do something bold. There's one other name I'll throw out that I did not throw out in the open that I think might be a bullpen option. And he would have to also be added to the 40-man roster because I'm looking. He's not on there. And that's Dylan Ross, who's pitching really well. I've heard some really good things down there. He's had command and control problems, and he seems to have figured it out in Syracuse. And he's a righty, and it'd be very interesting with the bullpen. And again, Reed Garrett has options. You have a couple of extra spots there on the roster coming September 1. And here's a kid who's, you know, has an ERA of 2.49 in LA. He's striking out 12 per 9. Yeah, he's walking 5 per 9. That's really not much different than what you see out of some of these guys that come out of the bullpen now. But he's a kid that throughout his minor league career has struck out nearly 15 per 9 innings. And he's 24 years old, college kid, was drafted. I don't think this is a Stearns draft. No, this was with the Billy Epler group in 2022. He's a 13th round pick from the University of Georgia. So, you know, keep an eye on that name too. And let's see how bold David Stearns can be. You can't make any waiver deadline deals anymore, but you can work with your organization. And as long as these kids are on the 40-man by this time next week, they could potentially be a part of the party here And who knows, you have some unlikely heroes that make their way into Mets lore for a potential postseason run. So hope everybody enjoyed this latest edition of the Talking Mets podcast. Of course, you could, you know, continue to go to Talking Mets podcast and check out the latest. And I'm really happy that you guys continue to support the next phase in the history of the Talking Mets podcast. As I always say, well, this is the new thing I always say, the podcast is always free and commercial free for everybody. And of course, we continue to add content throughout the week, whether it's audio, video, written, something that reacts to a topic, a player, a situation. The other day after the horrible loss to the Nationals, I did a quick reaction audio. Something that I think makes it worth your while to continue to engage with me and the community. And I'm going to try to set up some chats soon on the Substack so that you guys could potentially interact and throw some things out there. So if you're a free subscriber or a paid subscriber, there'll be something there for you. So check it out, substack.com/@talkingmetsnoG. All right, that's it. Hope everybody enjoyed today's show. Of course, you could check me out, as I said all the time, at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You can get me on X @talkingmetsnoG and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva @talkingmetspodcast.com, no G. Mike Silva @talkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on Instagram, Talking Mets No G. And as I said, I'd love for you to subscribe to the newsletter, substack.com/@talkingmetsnoG. Great content for less than the price of one cup of coffee a month. And as always, the podcast is free and commercial free for everybody. I am your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday. We'll be back with another Talking Mets podcast next week. Till then, take care, everybody.